on this exact day, March 12th, 2010, so 13 years ago, pre-ordering opened for this new device that had just arrived, this new technology the world had never seen before. I got one in front of me right now. We probably got 10 of them out there. Maybe if you're watching online, you're seeing my face on one of these right now in your home. The iPad was invented 13 years ago by Steve Jobs. And he said, this will be the best browsing experience the world has ever known. Every household should have one of these things. When a New York Times reporter asked Jobs how his own kids liked the iPad, he famously responded, they'd never used one. He didn't allow his own children to use his invention. In 2013, there was a McDonald's website for their employees that promoted health and lifestyle. The employees that got on the website, they saw how to eat a healthy, balanced diet. And it specifically said to stay away from things like cheeseburgers and French fries. So many things you see on the road today. Stop signs, the crosswalk, traffic circle, the one-way street, and several more. They were all invented by the same man. His name was William Eno. Eno was considered to be the father of traffic safety, despite never having himself learned how to drive an automobile. Alexander Graham Bell is credited as the first to patent the telephone. He spent much of his life telling folks how this would change the world, how communication would be different from here on out. But Bell actually refused to put a telephone in his own study. Bill Wilson was the founder of a world-famous 12-step program known as Alcoholics Anonymous. Since 1935, Wilson's program helped an estimated 2 million people in 88 countries get sober. At the end of his life, he had emphysema, and on his deathbed, he pleaded with the nurses for just 3 shots of whiskey. Chicago native Bill Hillman was a bullfighting enthusiast. He loved to go to Spain and run with the bulls. Hillman famously wrote a book entitled How to Survive the Bulls of Pamplona. 3 weeks later, when he was down there, he was gored by a bull. How do we make sense of this? This is wild. What's going on here? If you're with us today and you're newer to faith, or maybe you don't really consider yourself a church person, you don't maybe believe in God, you're on the outside looking in, one thing that I know has crossed your mind, I know it has, and rightfully so, you've thought this before, why do Christians so often resist the God they say they trust? Why do Christians resist the God that they say they trust? I mean, look, we gather in worship, we listen to sermons, we read our Bible, we pray to God, we talk about how great, how faithful He is, and we mean it when we say it. So many of the things we do in our lives, they point to God. So then why do we so often resist the God that we say we trust? We say we believe, but when it comes time for it, to forgive somebody, or when it comes time to take a scary step in faith, or when it comes time to love your enemy, or to stand up for the oppressed, or to live generously, when it comes time for that, so often we resist the God that we say we trust. Have you been guilty of this? I definitely have. I have. Are we just hypocrites? What's going on here? How do we make sense of it? We're kicking off a new Lenten series this morning, and we're looking at 3 men who were responsible, who were bent on killing Jesus. That is, in the days and the weeks leading up to his death on the cross, there were a few men who were leading the charge in carrying this thing out. And if you're thinking, why would we do a series on that? What kind of series is this? Of course, every message, every series, the focus is Jesus. The reason we're studying these men is because of the unfortunate reality that there's a little bit of all of them in all of us. If we look at them, there's a little bit of all of them in the hearts of all of us. The one I get to cover today is a man named Joseph Caiaphas. He was the high priest. Caiaphas was the most religious of all the religious. He was the leader of the Jewish elite. He represented someone very close to God. He would have been an expert in the Old Testament. He knew the Torah. And yet, Caiaphas made some critical decisions in his life that defied everything God stood for. His whole life he spent trying to follow God, and yet in the end he tried to kill his son. How do we make sense of this? How do we make sense? Let me give you some background and some context as we dive in here. Caiaphas' dad was a high priest. Caiaphas had five brothers-in-law who were high priests. Caiaphas was part of the most powerful Jewish family around. He had extraordinary wealth, in part because they collected back then what was called a temple tax. All the Jews from all around would send that in, and it in turn gave Caiaphas what would today be millions and millions and millions of dollars. So Caiaphas had all this power. He had all the means that you could possibly want in Judea. The only person that he had to answer to was Rome. Rome, Pilate, and ultimately Caesar. See, Rome allowed Jews back then to live freely in their empire so long as they didn't rock the boat, okay? Y'all behave, as long as you do that, you keep peace, then we will let you keep doing Jewish things here, okay? That was Rome's attitude. And Caiaphas, he was the main man. He was in charge of maintaining this goodwill and peace with the Romans. And that's how things went. He was able to do that for such a long time. This rich and powerful high priest had everything he wanted until a carpenter from Nazareth turned rabbi, until he stepped onto the pages of history, until Jesus. And what was the most threatening thing about Jesus to Rome and ultimately to Caiaphas? What was it? Well, Jesus wasn't violent. It wasn't necessarily his teachings. It wasn't his status or his pedigree. Jesus had none of that. The most threatening thing about Jesus to Rome and really to Caiaphas was the crowds. It was the crowds that would follow him. Everywhere Jesus went, hundreds, sometimes thousands of people would be swarming around him everywhere. Think about what they'd seen to this point. They'd seen him turn water into wine. He'd healed countless people. He gave blind sight. He made the lame walk. He calmed storm. He fed thousands. He even raised people from the dead. These people had seen it with their own eyes, eyewitnesses. So of course, they would follow him. Crowds would start to form. And that was really a threat to Caiaphas because why? Well, crowds meant the potential for an insurrection. Crowds meant the potential for chaos. This was an opportunity maybe for people, if they wanted to turn on the Jewish rule, to go against the Roman garrison with these crowds. And that would not be good for Caiaphas. And you know what? Aside from the crowds, the one other thing that Caiaphas hated about Jesus and saw as a real threat about him, the one thing that he couldn't stand was Jesus spoke with tremendous authority. Every time Jesus spoke, he just spoke with authority. 4 years ago, I went to summer camp as a volunteer camp counselor. I had a bunk of about 10 8-year-old boys. You're already laughing. Sometimes in order to find out how God has gifted us, we have to learn how he hasn't gifted us. And kids ministry is not, it's well documented, it's not my thing. And these 8-year-old boys, they sensed it right away. I just walked in and they smelled weakness on me. There was blood in the water. And one night, I was trying to convince them, hey boys, had a great fun day today. Time to brush our teeth, take a shower, and go to sleep. You'd have thought I was telling them they were getting root canals. You'd have thought we were lining up for amputations that night. None of them felt like listening to Camp Counselor David. And I picture the scene. There were kids jumping from their beds. There were kids swinging from the ceilings. I think I saw a couple of them shooting dice in the corner. I had lost all control in that bunkhouse. The smell of it still haunts me today. I'll wake up just as I was about to call my wife and ask her to come get me and maybe switch churches or move to a different state. An angel ascended from heaven. An angel was there. Mr. Schrader, a local teacher, a former college football player, a camp counselor in the bunk next to me, he came in to reestablish order. I don't know if he heard the boys yelling or maybe he heard me crying, but Mr. Schrader bust open that door and he came in with a sleeveless shirt and a stern voice and he said, boys, you will get in your bed now. You will shower, you will brush your teeth. When I come back in 15 minutes, I don't want to hear a single word. Lights off. I did the same thing. Well, that night, my group of smelly heathens had suddenly transformed into a well-groomed army troop. Most people don't speak with authority. I sure didn't. But when someone does, you just know it. You know it. I don't think Jesus was a yeller. I'm not sure that he was yoked like Mr. Schrader. But I know Jesus spoke with authority, and speaking with authority is something that we just, when we see it, we see it, when we, it's just there. It's undeniable. People lean in. Hey, what is she going to say next? What is he going to do next? That's genuine authority. Where did Caiaphas' authority come from? His position, his wealth, his family name. People were forced. They didn't have any other choice but to listen to what he had to say. On the contrary, though, these massive crowds, they follow Jesus everywhere because of a different kind of authority. Not out of obligation, but out of awe and respect and wonder for who he was, for what he was doing. Jesus' incredible authority was a threat to Caiaphas. And I want you to see what I think is kind of the final thing that sent Caiaphas off the edge here. It had all been building up to this crescendo that we see in John 11. It records the story. Jesus went to Bethany because a good friend of his was very sick. Everybody knew this man in town, but by the time Jesus got there, they'd already had a funeral. They'd already buried this man. And Jesus is way late, and his friend Lazarus had been dead for 4 days. Look what John says. He says, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to him, "Take off the grave clothes," said to the people, "let him go." This miracle wasn't done in isolation. This wasn't done in some kind of dream or vision form. This was a real event that many eyewitnesses were there to see. Everyone in the town knew Lazarus was dead. This man was gone. They saw his body. They went to his funeral. 4 days later, there were probably people on his social periphery that had already moved on, forgot about the guy to some degree. And then Jesus calls Lazarus out from the grave. And this dead man is walking alive again. So after all the signs, all the miracles, all the teachings, and now this, what's the only logical response to this? You've witnessed these spectacular things, and now 4 day dead Lazarus is alive again? Nothing makes sense but to follow Jesus right there. Nothing makes sense but to surrender your pride, get in line, and just bow to this great king. And many, many, many people did exactly that. Lots of them did. But some of them didn't. John continues, "Now the crowd that was with Jesus when he called Lazarus from the tomb and raised him from the dead, they continued to spread the word." Of course they did. Many, because they had heard that he had performed this sign and went out to meet him. So the Pharisees said to one another, "Hey, see, this is getting us nowhere. Look, the whole world has gone after him." Again, we see the crowds and we see Jesus' authority just growing. But a few things here, I think this is interesting. How do we get this dialogue? How did it make the New Testament, the perspective of the Pharisees? Well, Luke tells that many, many, many former Pharisees, former chief priests, many of these Jewish elite that were once Jesus' opponents, many of them followed him after his death and resurrection. And that's how we have this dialogue recorded right here. That's how John has the inside track on this conversation. Imagine this. Later on when John and Luke are investigating, when they're preparing to write their gospel, what happened, they're talking with these former Pharisees probably and these chief priests, and what would they have said to John and Luke? "Hey, you have no idea. We were so frustrated by what Jesus was doing," they probably said. "He drove us crazy. Every time we made a move, everything we did, well, Jesus just made us look bad. Every time we went after him, he won. Luke, John, no matter what we did or what we said, Jesus constantly made us look like fools." That's probably what the Pharisees had to say. And see, that's what the Pharisees mean here when they say, "This is getting us nowhere. This, what we've been trying to this point is doing nothing for us." Well, what were they doing? What was their strategy? You can read this in the Gospels too. Here's what they did. When Jesus was teaching, when there was a big crowd assembled, they would send their best and their brightest men to go to that and to try to catch Jesus. They wanted to kill his credibility. They wanted to disperse the crowds. So they'd go and they'd ask him a gotcha question in front of everybody. "Jesus, what does God think about divorce? Jesus, is it now okay to work on the Sabbath? Are you saying that that law doesn't apply anymore? Jesus, is it really fair for Jews to pay a tax to Caesar? Jesus, where do you stand on immigration? Jesus, what about gun control? Jesus, what do we do about these Chinese spy balloons? Jesus, answer us." And every single man, every single time, Jesus said something mind-blowing. And every man would turn away, tail between his legs. He made them all look like dummies. So that trick question strategy, it wasn't working anymore. The whole world, they said, has now gone after Jesus. Asking those questions really wasn't going to cut it. John continues, therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did, they believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. I want to pause here just for a second and try to explain the significance of this. So many times I've read over this and don't wrestle with the gravity of what's going on in this meeting, okay? The Jewish governing system was the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and they despised each other. I mean, that's really putting it lightly. It's too convenient of a comparison right now to look at our own country, the left and the right, how they treat each other. Think of that here with the Pharisees and Sadducees. They had different beliefs, different traditions. They were always in a power struggle. They didn't agree on anything. They never saw eye to eye on anything. They were just enemies. They were constant opponents. Until this carpenter turned rabbi started speaking with authority, started performing these great signs, started drawing these massive crowds. The fact that these groups came together for this meeting here, that just shows you just how real and how big of a problem Jesus was for enemies to come together like this to try to get him out of there. And they say here, what are we accomplishing? Here's this man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everybody's going to believe in him. And then the Romans will come and they'll take away both our temple and our nation. This is the threat right here. This is the verse that helps us see inside their thinking. What were the threats that they were going to lose their wealth? They were going to lose their way of life. Did you notice that the conversation was never like, wow, Jesus is really who he says he is. They didn't wrestle with, look at him doing all these amazing things. Maybe we should rethink what's going on here. Look at everything he's done. The conversation with them never even made it to that point. And why? Well, the only thing they saw was the cost. They were counting the cost. What's this going to cost us? If Jesus keeps doing this, what are we going to lose? What are we going to have to give up because of Jesus? That's where they were stuck. What was truly the biggest threat to the chief priests and Caiaphas and Rome? What was the threat? Well, it was Rome. You don't think if a man can raise people from the dead and can manipulate weather patterns, you don't think if he can do that, he can maybe ease some geopolitical tension? I mean, at this point, Caiaphas and those guys had to realize this man's power is limitless. They had to see that. They had to realize that he could do anything, and here's what we know about humans. Here's why they struggled then to react in a way that made more sense because of this. The truth will set you free, but there are some things we don't want freedom from. The truth will set you free. This comes from John 8. Jesus said it, but here's the thing about us, you and me. Sometimes we don't want freedom from things. This is why Jesus asked on occasion, he would say, hey, what do you want for me to do? What is it that you want? Strangely, when we're in prison sometimes by something for a long time, whether it's sin or a bad relationship or a miserable job that we love to complain about, whatever it is, sometimes we've grown weirdly comfortable with the prison of it. And at some strange level, we feel like we're still in control while we're in prison. And despite knowing the truth, we don't always walk towards it. And I want to tell you today, you know the truth. The next question is, do you actually want the freedom that comes with it? Do you actually want the freedom? Do you actually want to be free? Then one of them named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, he spoke up, said, you know nothing at all, he's saying to the Pharisees and chief priests. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. This is incredible to me. Let's read verse 50 again. You do not realize it's better for you that one man die for the people than the whole nation perish. Caiaphas is saying, hey, rather than all of us dying at the hands of Rome for being unruly or for being disruptive, how about let's just send this one guy to die on our behalf? One sacrificing his life as a ransom for many. Well, does that sound familiar? Caiaphas, I don't think he realized it at the time, but he nailed the gospel right there. And then John goes on to say, well, Caiaphas didn't say this on his own, but as high priest that year, Caiaphas prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation. And not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God. Jesus was going to die and bring everybody together and make them one. Well, from that day on, they plotted to make Jesus king. No, that's not how it goes at all. That makes so much sense. That would be the thing you should do for a man who's going to die for this nation and bring everybody together. That's not the response. So from that day on, they plotted to surrender their lives and follow him? Yeah, that would make a lot of sense too. Jesus, bringing together all the scattered people of God together and dying on their behalf, this would be the response. But no, here's what Scripture actually says. From that day on, they plotted to take his life. The lengths that we will go to when we see the cost. The lengths that we'll go to not follow Jesus, to continue to have it our way. In their minds, the only solution was the title of this sermon series, Killing Jesus. And not only that they would resist him, but when faced with his truth, when they interacted with, their life intersected with the beauty of what he offered, what he promised, they just would instead cling more tightly to their own personal power and wealth and security to preserve their comfortable way of life no matter what. That was their response. Well, under Roman rule, Jews weren't allowed to carry out capital punishment. They couldn't make any executions. So Caiaphas, he ended up overseeing this trial, and he charged Jesus with blasphemy. He sentenced Jesus to death by basically turning him over to Pilate, sending Jesus to the grave, killing Jesus. I'll be really honest with y'all. When I heard the title of this series, I just didn't like it. I hated it. We're calling the series Killing Jesus. I still don't really like saying it. It's jarring to me. It sounds irreverent. It sounds active. But I get it now. I understand. I've come around. It should get a rise out of me. It should, because this is the brutality that was aimed at him, to kill him. We shouldn't sanitize it. We shouldn't water it down. Nothing would make the enemy happier than killing Jesus. So the title doesn't really bother me in the same way anymore. Another reason is because I think it's impossible, killing Jesus. Yes, Caiaphas and some other men, they played a big role in leading Jesus to the cross, but are you really killing somebody if 3 days later he walks up out of his own grave? Did they really kill a man who said from the very beginning that he came to die for the sins of the world? Caiaphas thought he could kill Jesus, but all he did was orchestrate God's divine plan. He thought he could get rid of Jesus, but all he did was crown him king and elevate his throne. Caiaphas thought he could get rid of him, but all he did was usher in his eternal reign. Caiaphas thought he would make history in killing Jesus, but all he did was become a tiny little footnote in God's unstoppable, incredible love story to the world. What's really interesting is in November 1990, if you're mid-30s or older, what were you doing in the fall 1990? There was a construction crew that was working over in Israel. They were creating a water park over there. And in their digging, one of the bulldozers actually opened the roof to some kind of ancient structure. The crew immediately contacted archaeologists. They came and swept the scene, and they stumbled into what was a burial cave. Six of the different rooms in this cave had been pillaged by grave robbers some years ago, but six of them remained untouched, all the contents exactly in the same way that they were left. Among the bone boxes, this is why you need to know this story, was one very ornate, very special ossuary, which is a bone box. The name inscribed on this thing that looked different than all the others, Joseph, son of Caiaphas. Inside were the bones of what was a 60-year-old male. You could go see this today in the Israel Museum. So get this, Caiaphas, the man who would stop at nothing to erase Jesus and his following, the man who wanted to make Jesus disappear, the man who wanted to silence Jesus forever. Well, 2,000 years later, Caiaphas only adds to the case for Jesus' lordship. Only God can do something like that. One of my favorite things that I get to do in ministry is meet with engaged couples and do premarital counseling. Over the last few years, got to do this with a whole bunch of married couple or engaged couples. And the goal that I do in this short time that we meet together is really twofold. Let's talk about limiting surprises and managing expectations. That's it right there, is to set and manage expectations and to limit surprises. 9 out of 10 times when marriages are struggling, you can really trace it back to unmet expectations, or you never talked about expectations, and too many surprises. She isn't who I thought she was. He did things I never dreamed he would do. Everyone changes and grows and matures. We all become different, and that's good. It's just really hard on your spouse to put one image out of who you want to be, what you want your life to look like, and then turn around when you're married and do something totally different. That's just tough to do. It's tough for people to deal with. And I need to have a general idea of what my life is going to look like if I marry you. That's the idea behind it. Well, talk about hypocrites. Confession time. I'm a minister, okay? I wasn't 10 years ago, not even close. Wasn't even on my radar. I would have sooner been a chef or a kids camp counselor full time. Might have been just as good at that. I was educated with a solid job and a strong earning potential. On paper, my future looked like this. It was promising and predictable. My wife kind of knew what her life would probably look like. No surprises. Until she gets pregnant and she takes a night shift nursing position. And now I'm going to walk in and say, hey, I feel called to ministry. I'm nowhere near who I said I was 10 years ago. That person I told my wife I would be? No, hypocrite. I spent my whole life in basically climate controlled indoors until I'm 28 and move here. And now my family's like, where's dad in October, November? Wait, I haven't seen him. There's dead animals in our fridge. What happened? I am not who I said I was going to be 10 years ago. It doesn't match up with who I was projecting. False advertisement to my fiance back then. I'm a different guy. And that's not really fair. What happened? I was at a pastor's conference this week, okay, with Josh, Rick, and Zach. We were there Monday and Tuesday. And as I'm walking back to the auditorium this week after one of the sessions, I'm walking back in there, I see a guy I recognize. And I'm nudge Josh. I'm like, Josh, is that? And he said, yeah, that's him. So I walk up to this man. I said, hey, my name is David Wheatley. You probably don't remember me. About 8 or 9 years ago, you were the admissions counselor at Cincinnati Christian Seminary, right? Yes. See, during that time, I felt this strong call for God to go into ministry. So I went to seminary and I met with this man and I had all these excuses. I barely let him talk. I came in there with such a big attitude. I just met him and I let him have it that day. I said to him, hey, I just graduated with a postgraduate degree. I'm due for a promotion in my job soon. We just bought a house. I got tens of thousands in student loan debt to pay off. My wife just got a new night shift job. I volunteer weekly. I'm really busy. We have our first baby on the way. I probably can't afford seminary. I really don't have time for it. What do you think? And he looks back and he says, why'd you come today? Why are you here? I said, well, I felt like God may have been calling me into ministry. And he looked back at me and said, well, it does cost a lot of money. It is very time consuming. But if you decide not to do it, do you think it'll just go away? Do you think it'll just leave? I don't know what it is for you listening to here today or watching online. I don't know what it is for you, but I know God is calling you to make a move. I know that he's calling you to make a step, maybe away from something, maybe to something. He's ready and willing, God is, to move in your life. Are you going to answer? Or are you going to keep putting it off? I don't know what it is to be baptized, to get back in church regularly, to plug into a church, to be a contributor or a participant in the body. Maybe it's a big decision that you know you have to make. Maybe it's a sin that you've just let hang around. You make excuses for. You've got this pet that you're taking care of, and God's calling you away from it to repent and run towards him. I don't know what it is, but I know God's calling you to something. And I know in your mind, maybe the reason is not necessarily that you don't want to do it, but because you see it coming at a big cost. That's what it is. This sermon is not meant to tell you that you're wrong. You're actually right. Following Jesus, total surrender of your life, comes with a big price tag. It might cost relationships. It'll cost time and energy and self-interest and resources. You are right about that. You should know it that you're right. What this message is about and what the life of Caiaphas should teach us is it begins to answer the question that we posed in the very beginning. Remember, why do we so often resist the God we say we trust? Why do we do this? Here's why. We get tripped up by the cost. When it comes down to following Jesus, we get sticker shock. We see what it might cost us, and suddenly it looks more appealing to just go the easy route, to go our own way. But I want to ask you the same question that my admissions counselor asked me 9 years ago. This is for you today. It's going to cost you. But do you think if you just keep ignoring it, it's just going to leave? Do you think if you just pretend that it's not there, keep shoving it down, do you think it's just going to go away? I wouldn't want to test it. What we see in the life of Caiaphas and other men responsible for killing Jesus is this. We see the cost of saying yes to Jesus is great, but the cost of saying no is much greater. The cost of going our own way, it doesn't even compare. It's so much greater than saying yes to Jesus. This is the tragic message that we receive from the life of Caiaphas, a man who enjoyed all the comforts of life, wealth, power, influence, security. When Jesus crashed into his life, this carpenter turned rabbi, his very first thought was, man, this is going to cost me. That's kind of like us. What am I going to lose? His instinct was to preserve all the things he thought he needed, only to realize later that all these things were depreciating in value and none of these things actually ever really mattered in the end. So as we move closer to Easter in this Lenten season, we love to talk about what we're giving up for Lent. What are you giving up for Lent? What should I give up for Jesus this year? And I love that. It's a great reminder of Jesus' sacrifice for us. But as we close here this morning, my proposal is, what if we rethink that this year? What if we rephrase the question this year? Giving up something as a reminder of the cost, and following Jesus does require a big cost. So this year, what if it's not about counting the cost of your next step? What if instead, here's what I want us to do, what if instead we deeply consider, we really ponder on the opposite, the cost of saying no, the cost of staying still, the cost of spiritual stagnancy. How great would the cost of a safe and secure life really be? That's the question that we should ask. And I pray that when you add it all up, when you do the math, that you too would come to the conclusion that whatever God's calling me to, whatever he wants for me, it'll be worth it. It will be worth it. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for your faithfulness despite what we want to do. God, our instincts are often self-interest and what's this going to cost? I pray that you don't let those things be stumbling blocks, God, that we stop tripping over those things and that we could get a glimpse of your bigger picture that you see. You call us to big things, Lord. They require a lot from us. They feel very risky, Lord. But our message that we see in Caiaphas' life throughout the Gospels is the cost to follow you is great, but the cost to go the other way is much greater. I pray that we would be a church that answers that call as we look forward to Easter. We thank you for your son. In his name we pray. Amen. Hey, if you'd like to talk next steps or want to know more about this series, we have some game changers that will be out in the next steps room. We'd love to talk to you. If you're watching online, you can text the word next, 317-576-2288. Victor, do you have plans tonight? I would love to see you. 7 o'clock right here for worship night. We don't just go to church, we everywhere we go. Have a great week.